We are continuing in our sermon series called Jesus is the True and Better. If you've not yet seen the introduction to that sermon series by colleague, PCA pastor Timothy Keller out of Redeemer in Manhattan, I invite you to listen to the audio clip on our website. Essentially, what we're doing is we're learning together how to understand the Bible. Now, whenever I read a passage in the Bible, I'm ultimately answering two questions. First thing I'm seeking to answer is how the original audience ought to have understood this passage then and there. There's a second question which follows on the heels of that question, which is, how should I now understand this passage in light of the whole of the Bible, or in light of all that God has done redemptively to save a people for himself? And of course, those two questions are ordinarily very much connected, the answers to those two questions, that is. So we're reading the Bible in light of its grand conclusion in Jesus Christ. That's what we mean by Jesus being the true or better. And in particular, we're reading key episodes and events in the Bible as the Bible develops and moves moves forward as one organic story, as one whole culminating in Jesus Christ. And today we will see that Jesus is the true and better rock of Moses. We'll be looking at Exodus chapter 17, verses 1 through 7. This then, God's holy word. All the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages according to the commandment of Yahweh, and camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried to the Lord, "What shall I do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me." And Yahweh said to Moses, "Pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, and because they tested the Lord by saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Blessed is the one who reads these words aloud. So, in preparing for this passage, I remembered an article that I'd read some years ago in the Journal of Biblical Counseling. It's an article that one of my seminary professors for counseling had written, Paul David Tripp, and it's called "Grumbling: A Little Sin?" Question mark, of course. His point is that grumbling is no little sin. And I reread that article. I remember it had been impactful to me years ago. And then, while searching on my computer, I stumbled across something. I stumbled across a response that I'd written to that paper in April of 2001, 14 years ago exactly. And I didn't know it was on my computer. And I reread that article and reread the response that I'd written then. I want to begin today by reading you first a few pieces from that article, and then second, some of my response to it. So first, from the article, Tripp says this. He says that he wants to compare two lifestyles, one which is a non-Christian lifestyle, and the second which is a Christian lifestyle, the first being a complaint-based lifestyle, the second being a thank-based lifestyle. He says this. We want life without obstacles. I want my kids to make the right choices. I want a trouble-free marriage. I want a house that doesn't require maintenance. I don't want suffering, and I don't like the struggle. I want an easy life. And when it doesn't happen, I grumble. We want a life where we don't have to trust God. He says, have you ever heard the phrase, God will never give you more than you can handle? That is totally false. God gives us more than we can handle all the time because he loves us. When life is too much for us, we are supposed to cry out to him, to press into him, to have something to rely on besides ourselves. But we don't like that. We want an easy life. We don't like suffering. We don't want to have to trust someone else. And when we don't get our way, we complain. Thus far, Tripp. So here's what I wrote in response 14 years ago. This article made me realize that there is an amazing amount of ingratitude in my heart. I have everything in the world to be thankful for, but it's often the case that I get frustrated, that I grumble and complain, even when the slightest of things don't go my way. Just today, my wife and I were lost on the road after church. This is before iPhones. And I said, I got frustrated because we were running late for an appointment with friends. Instead of gratitude to God for my wife, for the car we were driving in the gorgeous day, like today, April, right? Instead of being thankful for our friends, the meal we were about to enjoy, not to mention the grace of God, which I'd just been reminded of in church, I spent the entire time grumbling about how I was ticked off because we were late. And more generally, how I was upset in life because I was late. I was behind on a number of things, and I was overwhelmed by being busy. Here's what Tripp says from that article. Isn't it remarkable that we have wonderful, activity-filled lives full of meaning and purpose, and yet we grumble that we're too busy? And I wrote, I am convicted that is me. Now, it's been 14 years, and I do believe by God's grace I've made some progress in these things, but I still have a lot of progress to make. I hope in the next 14 years I will grow even more in this, because for me, maybe it's like this for you, it's certainly this way for me, I tend towards being a perfectionist, and satisfaction, contentment with things comes difficult for me. I don't do well oftentimes in the practice of joy, not like I want to. And complaining and grumbling come all too quickly about the most minutia of things, even though I have a life where God has been exceedingly generous and loving to me. And all too often, I struggle, this is a big sin struggle for me, with having my life revolve around me, with self being the center of life. And then the subsequent sins that flow from that of complaining and grumbling, which lead to an unbelieving lifestyle. You understand, I mean not atheism, but a lifestyle that's rooted in not trusting in God and that looks like complaining and whining. So what hope is there for me, a chronic complainer? Right? What hope is there for you, someone who might likewise struggle with grumbling? Well, today in this passage, we're going to hear about how God meets his grumbling people and how he gives grumblers hope. Two really simple points for our time today. The first is this. The Israelites were a bunch of grumblers. All right, you ready? This passage is nice. It fits well with this theme of grumbling because first we hear about the event, and then we hear about the interpretation of the event. The event is that the congregation of Israel, some 2 million people strong, are traveling through the desert in stages. Of course, if you're following along in the story, you remember how God powerfully, miraculously saved his people from slavery and sin and death in the Passover and in the Exodus. He's now amazingly brought his people out of Egypt. He's parted the Red Sea. He's delivered them. He's provided for them. And he's constantly, symbolically showing that he is with them. By day, when it's hot in the desert, they have a cloud, symbolically demonstrating God's presence and providing for them shade. By night, they have fire, demonstrating God's presence, which gives warmth and light. God is giving them food and everything they could require, right? And he's said, I am bringing you to a land, a place that I will give you that flows with milk and honey. It's dripping with God's generous provision and love. And that's where they're headed. They've been saved for this great reality where God will be with them and they will be his people and enjoy his covenant blessings. But life in the desert is not easy. And thus far, they've faced some little minor hardships. And now, in chapters 15 through 17 in Exodus, 1 month out from being delivered from Egypt, they begin to face real trials, tests, right? This is the third one in. And the test is that there is no water. Now, you can imagine how a small band of men might make it through a desert, living off the land and so forth, being resourceful, right? But remember, this is 2 million people. Can you imagine the logistics nightmare that was? The only things they have, their resources, their provisions, are things they can carry on their back or drag behind them or load on a few pack animals. And they're a month into their journey into the desert. And how do you stock provisions? I mean, the army has whole branches that all they do is logistics. And this is a massive body of people traveling across a place where there are no natural resources. And now they've run out of water. And they're thirsting. And they have no water. And they have no place to get water. And so what happens, the Bible says they begin to grumble. They begin to complain. Who's to blame? Well, they want to argue with their leadership, as we often do when we're unhappy about things, right? They blame Moses. What were you thinking, Moses, right? You brought us out here. Certainly you have a plan. Where is the water? Now, if you've been in leadership, perhaps you see how Moses feels. He says to God, calling out to God, they would stone me if they could, right? I'm afraid for my life. These people are so upset with me. And you know what it's like when you have personal grievances and people are mad at you and how unsettling that is. Perhaps you've even felt as though if someone could, they would bodily harm you because they're so upset with you. So Moses, he calls out to God and he says to God, what shall we do? There is no water. The people are thirsting. So that's the event. That's what's taking place. But notice now their interpretation. That's what we do as people. Whenever things occur, when events happen, we're always ascribing meaning to the world. We're interpreting, we're making sense of reality. Now, the event is that there is no water. That's the indisputable fact, right? But notice how they understand the event, the way they interpret it. It's recorded for us in verse 3. They doubt God's presence. Verse 7, is the Lord really among us? And then verse 3, they grumble against Moses. They say, why did you bring us up out of Egypt? They question his motivation. They impugn his intentions. And they now say the most awful thing, the most nonsensical thing. We think you brought us out of slavery to get us to the desert just so you could kill us and our children by thirst. And it makes you wonder, like, how in the world could they have thought that, right? They've seen God's presence. They've seen his miracles, his salvation. It's just been a month since these things have happened. How could they have so distorted reality? How could their perception of things be so ill-conceived and wrong-fitting with the way the things really are? The truth is that whenever we begin to have this self-word orientation, where we think life is for us, and my desires, my expectations must be met, my desires are what's key, what's paramount. When we think the world and God and others owe us things, we begin to have this disposition of grumbling, it alters the way we perceive the world. And self becomes so big in our purview that it distorts everything else. It's like wearing rose-colored glasses. Everything you look at is changed, is made different. And the Israelites now begin to question Moses. They begin to question God. They begin to grumble. In that article I mentioned earlier, Tripp, he compares grumbling. He says it's no little sin. He compares it to letting a little bit of pollutant slowly into a beautiful lake, a toxic pollutant. And what happens, of course, is it corrupts the whole of the lake. And Tripp says, he cites the Israelites as an example here. What's happening is that the way they see the world, their relationship with God, all of it is becoming polluted and toxic because what's surfacing from their hearts because of the testing and the trial is this self-word orientation and grumbling, where they distrust God and begin, like Moses accurately perceives, not to quarrel with him, but to quarrel with God. Moses says, your argument, and let's be here, honest here, they're not voicing a prayer or something like that. They're not crying out with concern or asking God to intervene. They're grumbling against God. Moses rightly says, your argument, your quarrel is not with me, it's with God. Right? That's what the Israelites do. They are a bunch of grumblers. Of course, they are in good company. Many of us are the same, are we not? My friend sent me this snippet from comedian Louis C.K. Have you guys seen him? He was on Conan late night TV show, and he says this: everything is amazing and nobody is happy. And he uses technology as the foil for this, and airplane and so forth. It won't be very funny when I say it, but it's pretty funny when he says it. And he talks about the miracle of modern day flight. You know, that you can get on a flight in New York and go to L.A., and you're there in just a few hours. And he says, you ask someone, how was the flight? And they begin to complain that we had to wait on the mat for 30 minutes. And he says, it's amazing. You're flying through the air in seats. This used to take people 30 years to get across the plains, and they would die on the way and have children. And you get there in just a couple hours. And he says, we're the generation that has the most things, the most amazing life. And it's all wasted on us because we're a bunch of sniveling complainers. And of course, if you think about the world like that, you begin to see that we are super cynical. Talk shows, sports shows, TV shows everywhere. It's epidemic. We are full of grumbling and complaining, just like the Israelites. So what do you grumble chronically about? Do you not like your body? Do you think that if you were a few pounds lighter or a little trimmer, that your life would really be better? You don't think you have enough money? You grumble about your finances? You think that if you were rich, you'd have no concerns or cares? That makes sense because the rich never grumble about money, right? Do you grumble about your job, your relationships, your spouse, your children, your place in life, how you've been overlooked or snubbed or something of that sort? We grumble. We, like the Israelites, are a bunch of grumblers. So what hope is there for us? I think in Exodus 17, we see not only that the Israelites were a bunch of grumblers, but our second point as well, that God kindly rescues his grumbling people. So Moses cries out to God, and God gives him a solution. Verse 5, pass on before the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, take your staff. Verse 6, behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb. You shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people shall drink. Hence the name, the Rock of Moses. What's going on here? It's a really interesting passage. Did you notice first that God tells Moses he's supposed to go to this designated place that would have been well known then, the rock at Horeb? And interestingly, what he says is, I'm going to stand in front of you there, and I want you to strike the rock. There's not a lot of detail here. The Bible in this place doesn't much go into it. But what most theologians read when they or think when they read this passage is that God is actually telling Moses to strike him, that he'll stand in the way of the rock, or perhaps that he'll stand in the gap in front of the people, that he will take the blow on himself, that he will assume their guilt, that he'll take one for the team, as it were, or that he'll stand in the way of the consequence of their grumbling. When Moses strikes the rock that God's in front of, God is actually allowing Moses symbolically now to strike him in the place of his people. And then what's to happen after that? There will be water. Now, it's easy to read over the details, or this passage, without thinking about the details, but think now for a moment about this. First, let's talk about the rock. If you Google rock of Horeb, you'll get all these pictures of this amazing rock. Now, to me, it looks like a little smaller rock, like the Shiprock. You know the one I'm talking about on the way up to Colorado through New Mexico, Shiprock, that big, beautiful mountain that juts out by itself straight up, a big, huge slab of rock. Now, if you go to Horeb today, which you can do, presumably just like about 3,500 years ago when this took place, there is one gigantic, enormous, big slab of rock that comes right out of the ground. And interestingly, that rock is split right down the middle in half, with a gap about 3 feet across in between the rock. Now, there are plenty of archaeologists and Christians that say, this is the rock, this is where Moses struck it. I don't know if that's the case or not, right? It'd be hard to prove that or something. But it's interesting, at the least, that there is this enormous rock with a huge split right down the middle of it. And you can see on your smartphone or whatever when you leave. And not just the rock that's startling. Think about the water that must have come out when Moses struck the rock. So if you are traveling in the desert, how much water do you think a single person needs for provision? Let's guess super conservatively, right? Maybe 1 gallon per person. Conservative if you're thinking you're restocking, you're drinking, and you're traveling, right? There's 2 million people. 2 million gallons of water on a conservative estimate. So I did a little math. Federal plumbing regulations specify that bathroom faucets can flow at no greater a rate than 2.2 gallons per minute, right? Now, we've got two fire hydrants on our land. We're putting in a third. We've done two separate tests on our fire hydrants, and the average of these two fire hydrants is that they flow at approximately 2,300 gallons per minute. That's a lot more than your kitchen faucet, right? We have very healthy fire hydrants. And so if, let's just say, the rock was flowing at the same rate our fire hydrants were flowing, it would need to gush for 15 hours to get to the requisite 2 million gallons. And then, assuming there's no seepage in the rocky area, just for the sake of argument, there would be a pool the exact size of a football field that was 5 foot deep of water. And that's on the conservative estimate. Can you imagine the thundering water flowing out to meet the need of the people of God? It's no wonder that when the Israelites, when they sing about this, as they often do, we begin this worship singing about the rock, that God is our rock, that he provides and cares for us in Psalm 31. And Psalm 78, the Israelites sing about this deliverance. It's interesting. Listen to what they say. In the sight of our fathers, he that is God performed his wonders in the land of Egypt. He divided the sea. He let them pass through it. He made the waters stand in a heap. In the daytime, he led them with a cloud. In the night, he was a fiery light. He split rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink abundantly as from the deep, like from the ocean. He made streams to come out of the rock. He caused the waters to flow down like rivers. They tested God in their hearts by demanding food they craved. They spoke against God, saying, "Can God spread a table in the wilderness?" And he struck the rock so that water gushed out and streams overflowed. It's interesting in our passage, there is nary a criticism of the grumbling people of God. There's no judgment for them. There's no impatience. Now, if you know their story, they're only a month out, and their grumbling hearts will become more sickly. And this little thing will become a massive problem, and we'll see another rock in the future where this becomes even more problematic with these same themes. But right now, what we see is God, in his kindness, in his patience, answering the grumbling of his people and providing for them.
I think this is a pedagogical thing. I think God intends that his people would learn from him, and that in this event, they would begin to see their world differently. That he would banish their unbelief with his salvation, with his provision. Don't you think that God is seeking to teach his infant people that you are not the center of your life? That God has to be the center of your life. That your orientation, your disposition, it must be renovated, changed, remade. That God's salvation must reorient my focus. Of course, these things, this rock of Moses, these things, they contribute to a developing story which leads us to Christ. And as Christians, when we read this story, not only asking what it meant for the Israelites there and then, but how we ought to understand it in light of the whole of the Bible, something interesting happens. We see, at least Paul saw, that what happened there and then is true for us here and now. You know that Paul calls Jesus the rock of Moses, the true and better rock? This is what he says in 1 Corinthians 10. He's making a case that our position is like that of the Israelites, having been delivered from Egypt, yet on the way. I want you to know, brothers, Paul says, our fathers were all under the cloud. They passed through the sea. They were baptized into Moses. Speaking about the rite of initiation, baptism to the Christian life, he says that walking through the Red Sea was like that for them. They were baptized into Moses. They saw the cloud. They ate the same spiritual food and drink. So not only were they baptized, they had the Lord's Supper, as it were. They drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. What does Paul mean by that? I think he's saying that Jesus fills up or completes this story about God's salvation and provision for a grumbling people at the rock of Horeb. I think that Paul is drawing lines of connection. He's saying that we have seen God's provision. We have seen in Jesus God take the blow that we deserve, that a grumbling, complaining, unbelieving people such as you, such as me, might not receive the just consequence for our sinful hearts. And that having received God's salvation, now God intends to do something through us, having seen his miraculous provision, that now God intends to reorient our lives, that we might follow him, that we might be his obedient people. So we must not be a people who grumble. And the ordinary strategies we have of, you know, not saying something unless it's saying something nice, or you know, thinking about positive, these things won't work. We don't want them long enough or hard enough. We need God to change our hearts. Of course, in Jesus, God ultimately does that for his people. He gives them new life and new hearts, not hearts that are completely done with sin. We still have to fight. But now we're called to fight, to trust God, to interpret our worlds anew in light of his salvation and love, his gracious provision. We see that because Jesus is the true and better rock of Moses. Would you stand with me? We'll pray together. Our gracious God, we thank you for the way you intervene and kindly provide for your people. We thank you for your patience. We thank you for your love. We thank you for your sacrifice, that you are willing to stand in our place, to absorb our punishment. We thank you chiefly for the way this is true in Jesus Christ, the one in whom all of the stories of the Bible find their rightful conclusion. We pray, as we have been thinking about this one story, as we've seen your gracious provision, that God, all the more you would be at work in our hearts, in and with and through your holy word, by your Spirit, impress upon us the beauty of Jesus Christ, your provision in him, even more than in the rock of Moses. And give us hearts which are full of gratitude and joy, and live with belief and by your grace. We shall ask it together in Jesus' name. Amen.